that civilization worked and the way that knowledge was found and the way that resources were distributed was the way. It was the way that would be right for the entire world, and it would only be time until people who followed the ways of other nations would wake up and see that, in fact, their way was the true way, and it solved all the problems. The idea that one way of governing, you know, your way of governing, your way of extracting wealth from your colonies, your way of making knowledge is the true way, is the idea of the master narrative. So there were lots of master narratives. Each country had its own particular master narrative, as did each religion, and that's a slightly different way of dealing about it. I'm thinking at this point of the Christians versus the Muslims in the 12th century, the 11th century, the 15th century, and on, when they squared off with everybody being absolutely sure that they're completely right and that there is no other way and all the other paths are wrong. Those are master narratives, because there's no room for any debate and there's no room for alternate ways of doing things. Then came the First World War. And the First World War was a tremendous shakeup for all of it. First of all, because it became clear that the world was not going on in the way that it had. The First World War was a huge drain on resources, human and mechanical, and in terms of crops and money, natural resources, and everything else. Produced goods, manufactured goods, and natural products of the earth. Everything was severely damaged and its production interfered with by the First World War. After the First World War, Europe found itself devastated and in a completely changed frame of mind. A lot of countries realized that the idea of the master narrative didn't appear to work for them, and they began to withdraw either consciously or else by forces of economics to withdraw from their former territories and colonies, the places that they had colonized and were looting and in many ways had changed forever. England, most notably, with the end of the English rule in India, but also with other English colonies elsewhere, the Netherlands, Portugal, Spain, France, all of those nations that had worldwide empires now retreated perforce into their own boundaries. That's what happened to the master narrative. But the idea of the master narrative was very powerful. And one after another, nations continued to contend for who got to say what counted as the best of anything. So in a way, the idea of the master narrative changed from we are in control to who gets to say who is in control. And that was a major epistemic change, a change in the way that people thought. And it wasn't something that was necessarily done consciously. It happened in a very subtle way. And the major changes, which Saturday has already pointed out, were a general failure of the idea of the master narrative, the idea that there is one right way of doing things, and a consequent proliferation of a lot of contending ideas of the way to do things. The reaction to this, of course, was an increase in fundamentalism. And each fundamentalist group, sect, ethnicity, which is the way we tend to define fundamentalist groups now, though not exclusively, contended for the idea not that they had space, but that their way of doing things was in fact the way of doing things. In other words, they recreated the master narrative in another way, which is that when you're within their reality distortion field, then their master narrative is the master narrative, and the rest of the time is somebody else's master narrative, but you're always in the grip of some master narrative or other. One of the words for that is hegemony, which means, among other things, universal thought control. The fact that you believe willingly whatever the message is that is being put out. Now, of course, we have other master narratives contending, and those are much more subtle. They come from global corporations, or multinationals, as they're so-called. Oddly enough, the way in which multinational corporations evolve, grow, and persist looks very much like the way that primitive organisms evolve and grow and persist. They tend to engulf things around them and shit where they eat. They tend to find strategic alliances with other organisms and take them into themselves, the way that we did, the way that humans did with the organisms that were called mitochondria, which used to be things very much like free-swimming bacteria. Sometime a few million years ago, mitochondria struck a bargain with vertebrates, and the bargain was, hey, we'll get inside you and help make energy for you, and in return, you provide us with food, clothing, music, and you know, whatever else we happen to like, a place to live, and we'll get along fine. And gradually, mitochondria lost the ability to live outside of the hosts. We're in the beginning stages of that with global, or rather multinational corporatism. And we'll see where that goes. This is a life form we created, which is now, in many ways, beginning to run the whole show, just like a good parasite would, given the chance. The things that came along with postmodernism, along with failure of the master narrative and the rise of opposition fundamentalisms, was also, and this one is important for us, questioning of the idea that we can understand the nature of master narratives from within our linguistic frame. The idea being, if your oppression is built into your language, which generally they are, then how can you understand oppression as long as you speak the language that you speak, which is already a form of oppression? There are things that you can't say in any language because you don't have words for them. There are things that you can say, but that is inappropriate to say because there are cultural restrictions against it that are known as morals or ethics. And there are things that, if you say them, will get you hurt or thrown in jail or killed. And in this particular day and age, that has a lot to do with this wonderful thing we call terrorism and saying things in public that might get attention called to you. It has never been this bad. And for our purposes, that makes it a very interesting time, linguistically, in which to be alive. There's also a tremendous rise in surveillance and control, which is also part of the postmodern prospect. And that has to do with things like public cameras, surveillance cameras, growing rapidly in the United States, growing more rapidly in England, where they hope to have cameras in place very soon that will track the movements of every car in the country in real time, so that they will know where you are all the time. This is also true in the United States, although it's being done in a much more quiet and restrained fashion. And England, which is usually known for its quiet and restrainedness, sort of getting the jump on us in that regard. What do you do about the problem of having to break out of your linguistic control in order to be able to examine the roots of oppression? Well, what you do is you try to find ways to pull and tug at your own language in order to get enough outside of it that you can manipulate it by looking back in and seeing what's happening. There's been a fairly nice body of postmodern literature that is based on that, and some writers, notably, dare I say it, Michel Foucault and Jacques Derrida, who we will look at very briefly here over the course of the semester, have tried to do this. Unfortunately, what's happened is that so few people understand the nature of trying to get outside language as a tool for defeating the hegemony that comes with a particular language, that it became very easy to speak garbage and be taken as a postmodern theorist. And consequently, we had a lot of people running around simply out of control, and writing papers that largely didn't mean anything or that were very simple premises couched in extraordinarily difficult language, and passing themselves off as cultural theorists or postmodernists, and it became impossible to tell. And this threw the postmodernist critical movement into great ill repute, from which it has never recovered. Witness, if you go online and try the postmodern essay generator, you get something that is clearly ironic and meaningless, but that is also terribly close to actual things that get written. And a few years ago, a physicist at NYU wrote a paper which was published in a major journal of criticism here in the United States, which, after he got it published, he outed himself and said that the paper was just gibberish, and here it had gotten printed in a respectable journal. And what does that tell us about postmodernity and postmodern criticism? Well, that was a cute move, and it did show a lot of people up, and there was a lot of red faces and egg on people's faces going around. But it did point out that not enough critical attention is paid to separating what is actual criticism of the way that language works in a postmodern frame from just trying to get a job by talking language that most people can't understand. So that again is another part of a postmodern prospect. And monsters, that's what we're here for. We're going to do a lot with monsters, and they are part of postmodernity. And as I mentioned last time, the new monster, the monster for our age, is invisible and works by infection rather than by killing and eating your brains. Although killing you and eating your brains is a lot more fun, both for the monster and for you as far as a narrative is concerned. I mean, we do get the frisson of fear out of that idea. The idea of that which you don't see, which comes upon you invisibly and infects you and changes the way you think or act in such ways that you don't even realize it's happened, is something which is in a little bit more our actual prospect in 2006 in the time of the postmodern. So that's my blurt, and I'm sticking to it. But your blurt, when you get to do it, will be just as good as mine, and if it provides ideas for projects, that's my expectation. I don't have the last word on what postmodernism is. I just have one hit. My hit works for a particular set of circumstances, and it helps me get on with my task of writing theory. But that's as far as I go with it. So now it's your turn.